Well, we could get going, I guess. Question time for you. But remember, for Wednesday, there's some people that have Wednesday lab this week, right? Wednesday lab this week because of that snow day or whatever, they canceled us out last week. So you have labs. I'm going to be in there to help you. We'll probably try to streamline it through pretty quick. But that content, remember, is the content that's on the exam, too, that same kind of general idea of that lab. It's not too much to try to ingest about the concept of that lab, but what you gain from that, you want to understand the principles, because that was material before, right? And then what you covered in the lab last week, was it last week? Yeah, the conduction velocity lab, right? So try to pay attention to the take-home message of that lab as well. And that's the same kind of message that we've had in class on the concepts also. So Wednesday's class, you still have Wednesday's labs, you still have those two labs, and then the other section, Osborne section, actually has a lab that after the three to six lab. So I'll be in there to try to help all three labs with the intracellular recordings. We'll get that going. And what else? That's the labs, and then there's assignments for the labs, right? I think, what was the Wednesday one due? It's due Saturday, Friday? Right. Pay attention to that one, too, right? Because if you're doing that lab on Wednesday, your assignment, because there was an exam, I think Dan Lee offset it an extra day, right? Something like that. Okay, so I think it's Friday night, isn't it? Is it Friday night? Friday night. Friday night. So you got like a lot of physiology to do this week, okay? Do watch out for, you know, copying people's, cutting and pasting off the internet and Wikipedia and all that kind of stuff. Use citations. Reword in your own words. But watch out, those Turnitin assignments get checked across the whole, everybody else's assignments plus everything that's on the web. But Dr. Danley handles all the issues for the lab if there's some writing inconsistencies going on. Okay, so remember, this first exam is not so bad, right? Because some of it's review, right? And I made it where I hope it's easy and, you know, not tricky or anything. And, you know, the grade should be up, I hope, in the 80s for an average or higher. It would be great if everybody had 100. There are more than 100 points you can get on it, or 100%. There's only 80 points on this exam, right? 80 points. So you have a lot of multiple choice questions. I forget how many. And then you have some open response questions, very short sentences. It's like two sentences to probably answer the open response questions. So you got a couple of those. And multiple choice are 2 points each. So, you know, you miss one, there goes two. You miss another one, there goes two. You know, so it adds up pretty quick. Be careful on the multiple choice, just like the quizzes. Oh, shoot, I was going to hand back your quizzes, wasn't I? I'll get them. And in a little bit. So remember the quizzes were 1 point each, right? I think on those quizzes we had 10. So you kind of like, oh, I just missed one. But on the exam, miss one, you get 2 points off. So that's not good. So pay attention to the quizzes. I mean, pay attention to the multiple choice. On those quizzes, when I was going through, looking at them, grading them, I noticed a number of you had the right answer, and then you erased it, and then you chose the wrong answer. So be very careful about changing your answer, okay? Because usually your first response is the right answer. But do read through all your answers on multiple choice questions and then choose the best one. Process of elimination really helps on multiple choice questions, right? These don't make sense. I'm stuck with two of them. Get a coin out. No, I'm joking. Then try to, you know, figure it out. But they're not made to be tricky. Don't read into them too heavy. You can always say, well, exception is this, and, you know, if I think of it this way. But you might overthink it, right? So they're straightforward questions. And that's the way we should try to address these. But I don't want to, you know, say it's all memory work. You have to kind of understand the concepts, okay? So understand the concepts, and then we'll go from there. On the open response questions, it's very straightforward, but, you know, make sure you hit you know, read the whole question, underline the key element in there that you want to answer, right? Don't go off on some tangent and write a paragraph and hope you hit the right answer. Just answer it directly for what it's asking. And some of them have like two parts on the open response question, so like 1 point for each. So make sure you say one and two, okay? And then some students are taking the exam over in the DRC, and they might be taking a little bit earlier than you. Remember, don't chit-chat about it, because if there is ever a curve, maybe there is, maybe there isn't, that could hurt others or yourself. And then if you take the exam on Thursday, some people might be taking it later for other reasons. We take it Thursday. Might be taking it late Thursday afternoon, and I'll tell you again, Thursday or Friday for other reasons. But you don't want to chat about the exam because that could only hurt you in a sense, right? So just tell them it was really hard, you can't remember anything, you drew a blank. All right, that's your standard answer. All right, so what else was there on the exam? Oh, there's more than 80 points on the exam. I think there's 82 points or so. So if you miss one, you're going to feel good because you can still get an 80, 100%. All right? Sound good? Yes, all right. So try to get your questions together. I'm going to go run up and get your quizzes because I forgot to bring them down. I knew there was something this morning I had to do. So excited though because our Drosophila flies are ready to do some stuff, and so I was looking at those this morning and got all them worked up. So I'll be right back. Look up some questions that you have. Think, ask your partners what kind of questions do you have. You know, answer the test bank or something. Anybody? What does tau help us?
The time it takes for the potential to drop by 63%.
All right, 63%. So either drop 63% the amplitude, or the time it takes to rise 63% of the maximum amplitude, right? Okay, and why is that important? Temporal and spatial summation, right? Comes down. If it decays so fast, the next signal might not add on top of it, right? And then lambda... What does lambda tell you? What does lambda tell you for the... You know, how much it's going to decrease in a distance, right? So you can... It's a nice way to index or to compare neurons and maybe the properties. What would make lambda longer, for example? What would make the length constant longer, do you think? Where it doesn't decay as fast. Just some ideas. So you had a longer lambda, it doesn't decay as fast.
A larger axon diameter.
A larger axon diameter could be it. Why? Because less axial resistance, right? So the fire hose, garden hose analogy that we talked about. You know, these crazy things. All right, and so think about just the opposite, too. What can make it shorter? Smaller diameter, more axial resistance. Right? All right, so another question?
This is related to lambda. This is the like spring to, or summer 2009.
Oh, yes.
How do you answer that? Is it missing?
So there was a question on the old exam where it had an axon and it had arrows across it, and you were trying to calculate lambda. On there, the copy didn't come out at the different times and the events, but you could draw it in and like draw 100%, 50%, 37%, you know, and figure out what would you anticipate for lambda. That would be a great new open response question, but I already made the exam, so I can't put it in there now. Maybe the next exam. Remember, everything, I know you can't ask everything on the exam, so what we don't ask, we try to, you know, torture you with the next time. So, another question? Another question? Old exams? Did you get a chance to look at old exams yet? Okay, I'm sure there's some questions out there. No? Yes? We will have to torture you and ask things. That was a summer exam. So there was a question about on the old exams, there's some of them that had lots of essays on it and everything like that. Those are good to look at. Those exams were given during the summer when we had summer 350 to really torture you in 4 weeks. But they had a lot of time. They had like 3 hours to go through it. Just think of that. Exams for 3 hours. You get to experience that on the next exam. When we take it in the quiz, in the lab, it's not that long. Just getting ready. Okay, so I would look through those questions and kind of see if you can answer those. And if you have some questions on those, right now you can answer those. That's fine. Anybody have a question on some of those open response ones? Essays? Yes? No? Open response? Difficult questions? The question was, do we have to know the Nernst and Goldman equation? I would say, you didn't get your tattoo yet, which we've got to cover up during the exam anyway. I would say general
formula, but you don't have to memorize R and F. You know, you don't have to memorize what the values are, right? But you do have to know how to set it up, okay? So do know how to set that up, because that's a really fundamental principle, right? It's an equation. All right, another question? Yes.
So there was this slide about the current.
Yes.
And if you say how much shells there were, you said there were three. I don't know if you know this.
Yes.
How did you get to that?
Very good. Okay. I will tell you. Let me just get this one for a second. So the point on that question was really, that's quite interesting. It was a point about how to get how many channels are in the patch of membrane. So if we took a...
It. If you took a cell and you patched onto it, okay. Yeah, let's see where the thing is. That's really weird. Okay. And then we measured a response in there with an amplifier. We might see something, and you could give current pulses in here, for example, or maybe step the voltage up. But you take that patch off of the membrane, and now you have a patch electrode with a piece of membrane in there, okay? And then you can actually induce a voltage across this membrane because it's still in the bath, for example, but it's out of the cell. So now we know that we got a certain size patch of membrane. And if we give voltage steps to open up a channel, we could get current to flow through it if it opens up. So you give some kind of voltage step, and then you find out, oh, you got a channel that opens. And the next time you do it again, and this time we might see something like this. And then you do it again. Maybe you don't get anything. And you do it again. And you might see, you know, something like this even. Or you might see something like this, maybe. Right? You get the idea? So the idea is, what's the unitary size of these? It's all about this one. You know, this is all the same size, right? And these are like two, and this is like three built up. And this is one, two, two. So you'd say two, this one had three, this one had two, this one had one. You know, if you measured them all up, right? So the maximum number of channels that you've had that opened at any one time was three, right? You might have four. Maybe this channel closed and the next one opened in an experiment, right? But at least you know you had three that opened up at the same time. If you did an ensemble average of all these, every time you gave it a voltage step, if you did an ensemble average, then you see something maybe like this, if you did 1,000 of these runs, right? So these would be most likely like voltage-gated sodium channels. They open up at the initial part, but they closed, they didn't open later in the current step and the voltage step, but then you could measure these currents. I think in the trace that this gentleman's referring to is in the textbook that showed multiple types of runs, something like this, maybe, and it was just running, continually running along on the trace, right? So one, one, two, one, two, three. Get it? Even though the patch, but you're continually running your trace the whole time. And you gave some large voltage step, and you're measuring what happened in that time. But it was enough to open up, say in this example, it was probably potassium channels, a particular potassium channel that doesn't inactivate like the sodium channel would during that voltage step. So the maximum number of channels that opened at any one time was three. All right? The mistake that people have made in the past on those kind of, they count all of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but this is the same channel that's opening up, you know, it's closed, open kind of thing, right? So the maximum number of channels that could be in this membrane is 3. Now you can get a little bit more into it, but the general take-home point would be 3, okay? Does that help in that one? Yes? Does that answer the question? Okay, so that's that one. Let's go back to doing some quizzes. And, yeah.
actually a question from the quiz. With the question one, the reason that an active potential wouldn't be generated if a neuron was depolarized, and the answer being that the density of the voltage activated sodium channels is too low, how does depolarizing it remove the sodium channels?
Oh, no, it says, what would be the most likely reason an action potential is not generated in the dendrites or the soma of an axon? It's most likely there's not enough voltage gated sodium channels to, even though you reached a threshold to open maybe one or two, but it's not enough, a whole bunch of them, to polarize the membrane enough to threshold to then boom, an action potential. I know that could be, you know, viewed a little bit crazy, but it's kind of like that axon helix figure that we had where there's a high density voltage gated sodium channels, and that's where the lowest threshold is, but also where you're most likely going to generate a depolarization that's going to be great enough to. Okay. Reach an action potential. Okay, so we'll keep going, and then we can go over some other things as well. Okay. Yes. Speeding up the
myelination for one thing, right? So on the test bank, I can't swear that all those answers are answered correctly. Those come from everybody else in the past, like over the years, different teachers even.
Okay.
Myelination is really the fastest way to speed up. But also, what else? It's on diameter. So if you had a choice of multiple things to choose or an open response, what would you write? Myelinating the axon and then having a large diameter axon like the squid, right? So wouldn't that be great? Squid myelinated axon, that'd be fantastic. You know, that'd be the fastest. Does that answer that question?
Yeah.
I saw a hand over there somewhere. Yes.
Oh, the question I think the summer of 06 one about like a feature, I guess, for an experiment of like an electrical versus a chemical. I got the neuron reaction, and I was going to ask, like, would you just write out, like, the procedure for that? Or, because I know asking, like, if you were to experiment, how would you differentiate between those two?
Yeah, very good. So the question is about, reword this to make sure I got it right, the difference between electrical synapse and a chemical synapse,
yeah.
Right? And how to maybe experimentally do that. That's a good question. I didn't really go into that too much this time. So anybody have some ideas? Anybody have some ideas if you're going to do an experiment? No ideas? Electrical and chemical. What did we talk about that is repeated? What did we talk about that you need for a chemical transmission? Calcium. We need neurotransmitter inside the nerve terminal. But if you were going to do your experiment, you could actually stimulate in the back, the presynaptic, and measure the postsynaptic, and reduce the calcium level, right? Shouldn't really influence an electrical synapse, but it would influence a chemical synapse. What's another neat technique, we didn't really talk about it much, but they've actually done this in leech neurons, which is really fun, but also in culture neurons, when they're looking at synaptogenesis, and some neurons can make electrical and chemical. And what they can do is actually cool the preparation down, cool the saline down, right? That slows down more of the physical properties of like opening channels, right? Diffusion of the neurotransmitter. But electrical, those are those gap junctions, right? So you get an electrical signal really quick, and then you get that chemical synaptic response. But if you want to separate those two out, you can cool the preparation down, and you still get fast electrical because it just goes through the gap junctions, but chemicals slow down so you see a delay on the chemical. Isn't that kind of cool? Very neat. That's interesting. So that's kind of cool experiment. Some years we talk more about, you know, different things than what we talk every year about different stuff. Okay, any other? Those are really good questions. Yes?
Could you go over the quantum?
Yes, quantum hypothesis. Once I find this person's name. Collins. And we will go fix. Okay, we're getting there. Okay, so quantum hypothesis, really fast. We can do this really neat. Quantum hypothesis. It's so fun. Love it. We could just spend a whole semester on quantum stuff. But anyways, this camera's crazy. Let's see what we can do.
Are we in there now?
Okay. So, going back in history, 1954, Bernard Katz. Alright, so Bernard Katz, he did lots of different experiments. Let's look at kind of one that's relatively, I think, straightforward. Is he could stimulate or not, right, the presynaptic nerve terminal, and you could record in a muscle or a postsynaptic cell. Let's first try this without stimulation. So without stimulating the presynaptic nerve. And you just record underneath the neuromuscular junction, let's say, right underneath there, and you just record over time. And you get these nice little things like this. And maybe something like that. Okay? And we're going to say, oh, this one's kind of odd because it's riding on the other one. And we don't really maybe want to count that. So that one we won't count. We'll count the ones that look nice and clean. All right, so you can either count those.
We can measure them. We can measure them by peak amplitudes. Okay? So we get an average amplitude, or you can measure the area under the curve, right? But let's just do peak amplitudes and the frequency of the occurrences. So peak amplitude, okay, and this is in millivolts. And let's say we have a few that are small, right? A few that are bigger, you know, and it's something like that, right? So then we get an average size, average amplitude, or area, whatever you want to do. And this is the occurrences, so this is your histogram. If we look at this, let's just say the average, right down the midline here, let's say that's around 0.5 millivolts. Okay. Now what do we do? Now we're going to stimulate the nerve. But we're going to do it where it's sub-threshold for the muscle fiber not to make an action potential. But we're going to do this multiple times. So we're going to stimulate every time right here. We're going to measure these events. Maybe this time smaller. And if we increase the magnesium, what's going to happen? Is it going to get bigger or smaller? Smaller, because it blocks voltage-gated calcium channels. If we increase the cadmium, it blocks voltage-gated calcium channels. So these evoked responses would be fewer, right, and a smaller EPSP. If we raise the calcium, whoa, we might get the threshold environment action potential, so we don't want that. We could also use what? A drug that blocks postsynaptic receptors to keep it less sensitive, like Carari at the frog neuromuscular junction or your neuromuscular junctions, right? So we could use different techniques. And if you use too much magnesium or not enough calcium, then you don't get anything, right? So it's a zero. So you raise the calcium maybe a little bit more, and you get another event. The take-home of doing this maybe 100 or 1,000 times is that now you get a frequency of the evoked responses. And when you do that, you might have some failures. It depends on, you know, the level of calcium and everything that you had in there, or too much Carari. And then you start to see the distributions of the other events. Maybe you'll have a lot of small ones. Then you get some that are a little bit bigger. And then you get some that might be quite large, but still sub-threshold. But maybe not many of those, because you're trying to keep it under the threshold. And then you look at that distribution, and you see the average of these. Let's say this is 0.5, this is 1.0, this is 1.5. You get the idea that the evoked events is made up of the average size of the minis, or spontaneous events. So this is where Bernard Katz came up with the quantal hypothesis. Before there was any anatomy of the nerve terminal of seeing vesicles, he postulated by the physiology that neurotransmitter must be released in packets. And those packets are responsible for these spontaneous events. But also, when you stimulate the nerve terminal, either 1, 2, 3, or 4, or 5 packets are released simultaneously to get above threshold and then fire an action potential. Is that good? Okay, so that's, if you had to explain the quantal hypothesis, that's the kind of idea you would, you know, draw out, right? Are we good with that? Anybody confused about quantal hypothesis? Because it's fundamental for every chemical synaptic transmission that goes in your brain and everything. Last night, was anybody at NeuroCats meeting last night? No? Maybe? Okay. Not neuro majors. That's okay. It's all right. But anyways, the NeuroCats, there was a guy that was talking, Harry Levine. He works over in the Sanders Brown Aging Institute, and he talked about his experience with pharmaceutical companies and stuff, and that how somebody was actually doing the analysis of 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter, a millimeter cube of cortex in the brain of a rodent, and how many synapses they counted in that region. Wow. I mean, millions. And just a square millimeter. Some poor grad student spent their life doing that stuff. But anyways, you get the idea that there's so many synapses in just a square millimeter, and I mean just millions of them. And you just think, wow, that's so much going on in that little spot. And then you add that together, you know, throughout your brain, there's billions of synapses in your brain. And they're functioning by this response right here, you know, to give a response. That's enough. Another question somebody has?
Yeah. Okay, so you don't have to memorize. Now, if you get to memorize, it's like the atomic mass or something. Okay. Somebody, the gal in the blue shirt had a question.
Oh. This is asking about equilibrium potential for chloride ions, and it says that the equilibrium potential for chloride ions is below the resting membrane potential, and then the chloride channel is open. And what would happen? But then it also says that the chloride concentration outside the cell is 100 micromolars, or millimolars, and the chloride concentration inside is 10. So, based on the equilibrium potential, I thought that they would leave. But that also opposes their chemical concentration gradient, right?
So the question was with the E.
Let me pull that up. Was that was in the test bench?
No, this is the summer 2006
test. Right here.
Yeah.
Test one. Remember the question?
17. Also, is there an answer key at all for?
Oh no. That would make it too easy. No. The point there about the answer keys is that people that wouldn't just memorize the answers then, so I don't want you to just memorize the answers, you know how that goes, but to understand the concept. So the concept here, number 17, this is a good one to pay attention to. The equilibrium potential for the chloride, E chloride is minus 90. That's really something you got to circle, highlight. The resting membrane potential is minus 70.
I read it wrong.
That's okay. So what happens if the chloride channel is open right away? Where is it going to go? To E chloride. That's all you have to know. It wants to go to the E equilibrium potential, right? So it's going to go down to the minus value.
I thought it was saying it's at negative 90.
Okay. So, yeah, so this is really, sometimes there's extra information, like you saw in some of the questions that had E, you know, sodium, E calcium, but we told you those channels are blocked. So you get extra information in questions, you have to dig it out a little bit, like that's not pertinent to the question kind of stuff, okay? I'm not trying to trick you, I'm just trying to make you focus on what's important.
What happens if you walk the pump?
have a little sodium leak, you have a little potassium leak, and the pump keeps that battery, like when you dry out the cell, like the resistance in the battery, it keeps that potential there for you. Otherwise, it's going to go, the cell's leaking, right? It's going to start to go depolarize. Your cells die, right? You put an electrode in, you saw it with your experiments that you did in after you were recording for a while, you broke your electrode, or you stayed in the cell over a long time, you became leaky, you ran the electrode across your cell, and you cut open your muscle fiber, you tried to measure membrane potential, it was more depolarized than it normally would be a healthy cell. So, the idea is that, and remember the crazy kind of analogy I was telling you about, like with the water bed, for example, the old fashioned. When people used to put like a chemical in there, a mold inhibitor, but if it actually, it's an azide, if it actually blocked ATP production. You block ATP production, then you can't keep the pump going. And then that causes the cells to depolarize and you die.
Okay, so depolarizing cells, block the pump, depolarizes. What's another way to cause a cell to depolarize?
You know, block the mitochondria in a sense, right? And lack of ATP, they're going to depolarize. Another way that you did it in your labs, what did you do in your lab experiment when you measured some of the Wednesday class? I know didn't do the lab yet, but your other guys, what did you do on the Monday and Tuesday labs? What was your variable that you were looking at? Membrane potential. What was the conditions that you were doing in those labs? What were you changing in the bath?
Concentration of? Extracellular.
Yes. You're right there.
Yeah.
He's got on the tip of his tongue. Extracellular what? Was it calcium? Magnesium?
Potassium.
So you were changing extracellular potassium concentration and your resting membrane potentials went up, right? And so that tells you it's leaky. Now, it didn't maybe exactly follow the Nernst equation for potassium if you start changing the values. Why was that? Did you have to write that in your reports? A little bit? Maybe. Maybe you did. Maybe you didn't. Not through the calcium channels, but because there's a little leak of sodium too, and especially at the lower levels of potassium, sodium plays a more dominant role, and it will deviate from the Nernst equation, that line. But you always have a little leak of sodium too in there, so it's not exactly right on. Okay, is that good? Are we all there? More questions? Yes. The inhibitor and the exciter, particularly about your favorite preparation, the crayfish preparation. When they were doing those experiments earlier on, there in the muscles that you've worked with, there's an inhibitor and an exciter. We call them inhibitors and exciters, but really that's not the best way to describe it, right? Because it's really it's not so much the transmitter that makes it excitatory or inhibitory, right? What is it? The receptors, right? So, but in general, we say excitatory and inhibitory. So one's GABAergic, one's glutaminergic. If you stimulate the glutaminergic, you get a depolarization, right? You get a nice depolarization of the muscle fiber. But it kind of relates to the question this gal had up here in the blue shirt, too. Sorry, I can't remember names. Very bad. Whoops. Okay. So if we stimulate the exciter and we have an intracellular electrode in here, we get excitation and depolarization. It's glutamate. And glutamate receptor is an inotropic receptor. Sodium rushes in, a little bit of calcium comes in, but it generally depolarizes. The inhibitor, which is GABA, in this preparation, it all depends on, relating to that question, where is the reversal potential or equilibrium potential for the chloride ion? Because the GABA one will open up chloride channels in the membrane. It's an inotropic receptor, and it will open up and allow chloride to flow through. Okay, so it allows chloride. It depends where the E chloride is. If E chloride is down here, then if we stimulated and recorded, we would see something like, from the resting membrane potential, we would see it going down towards the E chloride, right? If the E chloride is at, if E chloride is at the RP, the resting membrane potential, and we stimulate the GABAergic, what would happen? There's no driving gradient, right? So it stays the same. That kind of drove the people crazy early on when they were doing these experiments because they couldn't see a response. It depended on what they did to the conditions. Now, what they did experimentally is they varied the concentrations of chloride on the outside, and they could change the equilibrium potential. That's kind of neat. Later on, people did neat experiments like you did in your lab. You used KCl in your intracellular electrode. You used 3 molar KCl in your intracellular electrode. They actually injected KCl into the muscle fiber. Potassium's already high, but they're not worried about the potassium so much at this experiment. And they injected and got a lot of chloride inside the cell. Basically, what they did is change the equilibrium potential. So they injected so much chloride inside the cell that when they stimulated, they could actually get a depolarization because E chloride became more above the resting membrane potential. So understanding those concepts is really important, okay? The other experiments on that, and someone pointed out that it's a little bit confusing in the textbook on one of these issues, but generally, if you think about, if you stimulate the exciter and you get a depolarization, if you stimulated the inhibitor not so close, but just a little ways away, then you're going to bring this back down sooner than you would a normal excitation. And the reason is because you've opened up these chloride channels and it wants to go to the E chloride quickly. If you stimulate the inhibitor and then stimulate the exciter, if they're close enough together, you might see the hyperpolarization. You might see the depolarization. If they're far, far apart, if they're really close together, then you might block the excitation and you might not get a very big response. The other point about those drawings that we were making is that in some of the preparations, particularly the opener muscle for the claws and the walking legs, is that the inhibitor has a branch that goes over to the exciter and it inhibits the presynaptic nerve terminal of the exciter. So that's called presynaptic inhibition. Important because that was the first time it was ever described, 1961, and then that opened up to think about that's happening in mammalian systems, like in your spinal cord and in your brain. And then people started to look for those, and they found them, but they never even thought that that was possible. But it was shown in the crayfish neuromuscular junction, and then that made it kind of feasible that that might be happening. And now we know that happens a lot in our nervous system. So some really interesting discoveries with your favorite preparation. Okay, other questions real quick? Anything? So, and I have all the old test banks here and everything if you wanted to go through any of that. But just because I know that you probably, some of you haven't studied yet. Okay. And you're waiting until like Wednesday night and you're going to stay up all night long and you're going to come in exhausted, tired, and then you're going to make silly mistakes on the multiple choice because you're too tired. So don't stay up all night. It's important to sleep. You can think better. And you'll do better if you get a good night's sleep. Okay. So, but if you think about it, if you go back and you just look over the chapters or the PowerPoints, and I've got the PowerPoints here too if you want to go over any of them. You know, if you look at chapter one, what were the big things in chapter one that we covered? Any ideas? Homeostasis, right? And how does this happen generally? Negative feedback. And we also talked about this crazy camera. Okay. Maybe I can unzoom this thing. No. can't. Okay. Conformers and regulators, right? Conforming to your environment, regulating in your environment, right? We talked about that a little bit. Okay. Chapter 1 is done. Chapter 2, what did we cover in chapter 2? Pardon?
The August principle.
Yes, the August Croak principle, right? Really cool, right? Very neat. The talk last night by Harry Levine, actually in the Aging Institute, so you don't have to memorize all these techniques. It's kind of cool to look at those. He actually mentioned that there's no good model for Alzheimer's experiments that you can do. There's no really good rodent model. There's no really good mouse model. And they've looked at monkeys, primates, monkeys that have been 60 years old, and they even looked at gorilla brains, you know, from gorillas that have died, and they do not find these Alzheimer's plaques are an Alzheimer's model. So other primates and rodent models, there's no real good August Croak type of principle to look for Alzheimer's in these animals. But they know like plaques are made in alpha-synuclein and all these different compounds, so they try to induce it in these mice models, but it still doesn't show the same kind of properties as a human with Alzheimer's in their brain. That's kind of interesting. So some animal models are just not good to address some of these questions. So that would be falling short, right, for August Croak principle. Okay, chapter 3. What's chapter 3? Glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain is the primary part of that, right? And everybody knows that by now because you've had it 100 zillion times. But also water. We talked a little bit about water. What's so unique about water? Water. What happens if we heat water up? What happens if we heat water, cool water down? pH changes, right? Because everybody's been lied to about the pH equation over the years, right? pH equals the negative log of the hydrogen ion times activity coefficient. And that activity coefficient relates to the disassociation of whatever you're measuring. And so there's a temperature factor in there. And so with temperature, pH changes, right? Right? Yeah. Okay. And disassociation, more hydrogen ions. Higher hydrogen means what? Higher pH or lower pH? Just, I know this is silly in a sense, but people get that confused every year on a test. I see, oh, I forgot. Higher hydrogen ion means lower pH, right? Okay, just to make sure we're all on the same page. All right, and then enzymes and things like we talked about, I shouldn't say things, like pumps, proteins that work, are dependent on pH, temperature, salt concentration, right? Because that changes what? The conformational change of that enzyme and how it can work. So all those are important for temperature regulation. We got a little bit into glycogen storage molecules, ATP, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary structures, right? Primary, secondary, right? Tertiary, are we thinking a globular protein, right? Quaternary, good example, only one I always keep hearing about. Hemoglobin, right? Multiple globular proteins coming together. Alpha sheets, beta sheets, to kind of re-memorize all that stuff. What else did we talk about? ATP. What is ATP for? What do you do with ATP? How is it a energy molecule? What does it do? Phosphorylates, right? Key. And this year we didn't really go into the enzyme kinetics and things. Some years we spent more time with it. In the past we did, but we didn't really go into it too much this year, so don't worry about that. You see that in old exams, freaks people out. But we didn't really hit much about that. We did go through, you know, where these processes take place, right? Glycolysis, TCA, and electron transport chain. So we should know these processes. What's that water called at the end of metabolic water, right? That's why the desert kangaroo rat doesn't have to drink water. They can get their water from breaking down carbohydrates, right? Okay, see, chapter 3 is done. Not bad. Now we're on chapter 4. And this is where we started maybe getting into some new content, right? Chapter 4. We talked about the bilipid membrane. And those are always, you know, fun questions that you see on all the old exams, right? Think of your fingers, right? And if you started to move some of these to be shorter or longer, that increases the movability, right, of the those carbons that are together, it breaks up that van der Waals forces, right? Or if you had kinks in it, how do you get a kink in the carbon chain? Like a double bond, taking away a hydrogen. So you're unsaturating the long carbon chain, you're unsaturating it with hydrogen ions, and you get a double bond. So I know that sometimes gets confusing, but if you have that double bond, you unsaturate, so it's not with the two hydrogens, that's the way it's termed, and you get those kinks, and then it becomes more mobile. Here's where people get confused on the exams. You take a cold animal and you move it to the warm, how does it want to change? Or you take a warm animal and move it to the cold, right? And then people get it confused because they memorized an answer on an old exam, but the conditions changed, right? We flipped it around just to play with your mind. No, it's not to play with your mind. It's to make you think about the concept, right? So when you're stuck with that, just think of butter going to the freezer or going out on the tabletop, right? And it's in the freezer, it's too hard, but you want it where it can actually function, where proteins can move in it. So what can you do to decrease its stiffness, right? You can do these things, right? Change the lengths, put double bonds in there, right? Unsaturate. Okay. And then we get into the electrical gradients, which we've covered a zillion times. And you, remember, we told you you don't have to memorize like concentrations inside and outside of cells right now. When we get into some other aspects in the renal system, we're going to have to know some numbers in the mammalian system. Yes? Oh, yes. So number 5 on the quiz.
You said you
want to sit in the number. Yeah. Okay. So number 5. I think everybody has that now. So we're taking an animal, the key mechanism by which temperature conformers cope with changing temperatures to vary relative proportions of saturated and unsaturated fatty acids in their lipid membranes. So when you see a question like this, the things to do is to acclimatized to hot summer temperatures when the animal's taken from the cold. So it's like coming out of the freezer, and now we're going to go into the hot summer environment, right? So taken from the cold in the summer, so placed in the warm. So if you place it in the warm, what's going to happen? It's going to become too fluid, right? So you want to try to keep that where it can change its membrane, keep its membrane fluid. So what did we write here? So, so into the warm, so in the cold, and into the warm, I mentioned just the opposite. So you take it to the warm environment, and it's going to become too fluid, right? It's going to, the butter's going to melt. So how to keep the butter from melting? Make it stiffer. How can we make it stiffer? Saturate, right? Make stronger van der Waals forces. So we can make it stiffer. If it's in the cold, it's probably going to have more unsaturated to make it more fluid, right? To make it more liquefied, if you will. Is that kind of the way to think about it? So now we want to, if it's going to the warm, it's going to become too fluid, and so we want to stiffen it up. Okay? Is that the way to think about it? Don't try to read into it too much. And I know there's a time factor and all that kind of stuff, but just a general point, all right? The cholesterol question, you have those on old exams too. I tend now to kind of think that's, it's in the old textbooks pretty much, but, you know, there's, it depends on the animal. And it kind of gets confusing a little bit with cell because people overemphasize putting cholesterol like into red blood cells, erythrocytes, and that changes the membrane fluidity, if you will, and if you get too much cholesterol in there, way above physiological realm, then it becomes more fluid. And that's what you see in some cell biology textbooks, experimental conditions. But in general, if you look at some animals, if you increase the cholesterol in the physiological range, in the membrane, they generally can decrease their membrane fluidity. It's kind of interesting. You would think it would break up the van der Waals forces, but for some reason it makes it a little bit less fluid. But if you go too high, then it can make it more fluid. So I don't really like that question too much. It's on the old test. I'm generally trying to go away from that question on new tests. Hint, hint. Okay? All right, so we can, if you got a question, you know, just yell. Transport mechanisms, we talked about that, right? Different types of transport mechanisms, right? If you need energy, you don't need energy. What's facilitated versus just goes right across the membrane? Does gas need ATP to go across the membrane, like CO2, carbon monoxide? No, because it can just be go right across. Saturation with either channel or facilitated transport. Right. Ion channels, what makes them selective? You know, we talked about some general principles there. And then here's your gap junction question, but we didn't, you know, go into too much about it. But gap junctions allow ions, small ions to go through, small molecules to go through, but not large ones. Mostly, we'll talk about that when we get to the heart. So you see chapter, whatever the chapter was, 4 is done. And then we have 5, and it's all those same kind of principles. Yes, question. Oh, yeah. Well, it depends on the channel. So some, it depends if it's a bigger channel or a smaller channel. The question was about the debate about water going through the channel. Some people are wondering if the water goes between the ions, but that's kind of too academic for this. If it's a sodium, then water, then maybe another sodium, then water. Or does water even go through it at all in some of those channels versus just the ions themselves? So don't worry about that kind of detail. But we do have to worry about details of what, how does water play a role if it was around like a sodium ion, right? You got a sodium plus. So what's going to be attracted outside? The oxygen part on the water molecules, right? So the oxygen, and then you got the two hydrogens sticking out. So what has that done? It's made a bigger diameter for that sodium ion. But not only that, if it tries to get through that channel, what does it have to do? Some of those channels do not allow that big sodium with all the water around it to go through, so it has to strip off the water to be able to go through. So that's called a hydration sphere. Hydration for like water, right? So depending on the hydration sphere, that can influence if the ion goes through the channel or not. Also, like a lithium goes through a sodium channel easier than sodium itself. So lithium will go through, it's a smaller molecule, and people might have heard of, I don't want to know if you're on it, lithium treatment, right, for psychiatric situations, and it's stopped because it displaces the sodium. Okay, so it's kind of neat to think about. So size, hydration sphere, and then what else? What's the difference between sodium and chloride? Charge, right? And then you get the protein channel itself is made up of amino acids, right? So are those amino acids negative or are they positive? And that's going to be an attractant or a repellent from the ion, right? So, you know, that's kind of the general concept and that stuff. And so we talked about neurons, action potential, graded responses. We've, you know, really gone on about resting membrane potential and what that's driven from. You don't have to memorize all the different channels and what they do, but generally the general concepts are, there's lots of different types of channels out there, right? And, you know, how they function is very important. And we didn't talk about all the blockers or anything, but some of the general ones that we should know, like cadmium, magnesium blocks calcium channels, right? We'll get into some of these others a little bit later, too, when we get going. But generally, the model of the membrane, right? What's the channel? See that? It's a resistor, right? And this is the capacitance. The capacitance of the biological membrane. If you wanted to draw in here, you could draw another line across here and draw a pump, right? And the pump is the battery, right? So the pump is the battery for the cell. And, you know, we've covered that over and over. Nernst equation. Golden-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Lovely stuff. We've talked about the shape of the action potential, graded responses, right? Why you get, you know, absolute and relative refractory, right? Voltage-gated sodium channel and activation, starting to get recover, so you get relative. We've talked about why you might get different kind of responses, density of types of channels, like potassium, sodium, calcium, squid axon, beautiful thing. Almost as beautiful as a crayfish, but anyways. You know, a lot of work done in those. We talked about, you know, you could use blockers to block sodium channels and then maybe measure the potassium channels, or the other way around. Block the potassium channels and you can measure the sodium current, right, when you do experiments. And then we just talked about the questions that the gentleman had in the back about patch clamping, for example, right? That patches of single channels, really a very powerful technique, because now they could understand how single channels work and understand then putting it together for the whole cell. We didn't go too much into structures of ion channels. It's beyond what we cover. If you're interested in that, there's text on that. Then we get chapter 6. And you see where then we're done. You got the test. Everybody's going to make 100. All right. Chapter 6, well, we talked about this. Length constant, right, already. What makes the difference of the electrical events traveling down the axon, right? If it's leaky, it's going to decay faster, right? If you got that garden hose that you've stabbed your ice pick in and made it a soaker hose, you leak all the current out. So if it's leaky, you lose your potential faster. So lambda would be, you know, short, right? So kind of ideas like that. And then we've talked about capacitance. And there's lambda. We've talked about tau. You see, I didn't want you to have to memorize this equation of lambda, because it really, if you look at other texts, it really varies depending on the type of axon. So this equation is not standard for all axons or all cells. So it's a little bit more detailed. But in general, you see the principles that are in there. Membrane resistance and axial resistance down the axon. So down the axon, axial resistance. So that's the idea, the general idea of the garden hose and the fire hose. Okay. That's kind of a neat little graph. That's what you did in lab already. You know, stimulated a whole nerve with multiple axons, right? Different size axons. So if you were recording at one end, if you had a suction electrode at one side of a big nerve, like your sciatic nerve, you take it out, you stimulate one side, and you record on the other side, and there's many neurons in there, hundreds of neurons, let's say, what's going to be the first ones that you're going to record? Is it going to be the smallest ones? Is it going to be the unmyelinated ones? What's going to be the first ones? Myelinated large ones, right? Because they have the fastest conduction. What would be the next ones? Maybe myelinated smaller ones. And then what are the slowest ones? Maybe the unmyelinated, you know, ones, right? Because they're going to be slower. So you're going to see all those slower. So you understand that compound action potential, right? Are we good? Right? Then you could break those up. You could maybe dissect those out. Let's say you could dissect it out and just get the big ones, or just the intermediate ones or the smaller ones, and just record those. And then you would see which ones relate to that compound response, right? And that's exactly what they did, these kind of experiments like that, and figure that out. Okay, so you should kind of understand the compound action potential. And remember, that's of many neurons. That's not a single neuron, right? This is, could be of 100 neurons or 1,000 neurons that make up that trace. What would be the trace if you recorded from just one of the, say, intermediate type of neurons? What would you see on this kind of trace? If you had to draw it on top of this, what would you see? What do you think? You have an intracellular electrode in one axon. Let's say it's a beta type of axon size. What would you see? You're going to get what? An action potential, right? If you had an intracellular electrode in there. And it's only going to be one of them, right? So, action potential, right? And it comes off, right? Got it? Okay, so, you know, try to think about the general concept. All right. And if you're a little confused still, look back at that table, right? We've had those on old exams, so, you know, that's generally the idea, right? Don't try to memorize the numbers, just general concept. Really depends on the animal and the temperature and all that stuff. And then we go back to our wonderful chemical synaptic transmission, quantum hypothesis, which you've got ingrained in your brain now, and presynaptic properties, postsynaptic properties, It's the receptor, not the transmitter. It's really the receptor and the driving gradients. We just talked about presynaptic inhibition and excitation inhibition, chloride type of responses, and then the quantal hypothesis we talked about already, right? Talked about that. We talked about vesicle fusion events, transmitters. Don't have to memorize structures. Don't panic, right? Just a general idea. They're small, usually amino acid-based, right, structures. Few enzymes like glutamate decarboxylase changes a glutaminergic neuron to a GABAergic neuron because it converts that glutamate into GABA. Very efficient way to do it. Okay, and we talked about uptake properties, you know, how it clears the synapse, could be uptaken. We didn't talk about an enzyme too much like acetylcholine esterase, but we mentioned it breaks up the acetylcholine. All right, and then we got into channels again. Metabotropic ones work through second messenger cascades versus inotropic ones. And where else are we? Cytospike initiation, high density of voltage-gated sodium channels. Okay. Kind of relates to tau and lambda, right? Integrating the signals down the dendritic tree, for example. So to get to threshold, so you don't decay. We talked about presynaptic facilitation, right? STF, short-term facilitation, mostly due to what? Residual calcium hypothesis, again, put forward by Bernard Katz. All right, and that's kind of what we had with this, right? Presynaptic calcium. LTP and LTD, what did we talk about there? Remember? LTP and LTD, long-term potentiation, long-term depression. What's the key factor that's changing here? AMPA receptors, right? Going into the membrane or pulling out of the membrane, generally, right? Okay? So it depends on the activity that happens ahead of time. Oh, my goodness. Look at that. We're done with Chapter 6. We're into Chapter 7, which is on the next test. Okay, so not so bad. I think everybody's going to make 100. Right? Everybody's going to make 100.
Calculators.
Oh, so you do not need a calculator for this exam. And if you are taking over in the DRC, your calculator will be taken away from you. And you don't need to be wearing a watch with Apple Tune for the test on Thursday and no earpieces. And we're going to sit in nice little rows. And I have a feeling that most of you will finish within 20 minutes or 30 minutes. You're going to get out of here early. And go get
We didn't go into any of that.
So like, just the August program.
Okay. All right. Cool. Okay. Thanks.
For chapter 2.
Yeah. Okay.
So is that good?
That's good. No, I mean, you know, the practice exams have a bunch of it on there.
Yeah. It depends. So, because those are even from other instructors.
Okay.
But
well,
I try to not torture people. Just a little torture.
Hi. Hi, Haley. a couple questions.
My car needs gas, and I don't have the money for that.
Let's go to a war show in the middle of stuff.